White Noise Podcast. We show entertainment stuff. Billy and Seth, David and Billy, and David and Seth, and Billy again. This is the best show in the entire world. Movies, TV, video games. Enjoy the show. Hello, everyone. Welcome to White Noise Weekly on the White Noise Podcast, episode number 12. We've had a lot happen since the last show. I mean, Jurassic Park World became the biggest box office opening ever. E3 just happened. Game of Thrones finale. So joining me, of course, like always, David Hunter and Seth Juniak. Welcome back, guys. I'm Billy White. Yay, me, White Noise. Anyways, yeah, guys, let's go, yeah.
You didn't even mention the Silicon Valley, finale. That was pretty cool, too, but... No, I mean, yeah, you're right. Everything happened, and now we've got to talk about it all, which is a cloying task, but one we will take with heavy hands and, yeah.
I mean, it's funny. On a week where Game of Thrones finale comes out, and a lot of stuff happens that we'll cover up later, but, I mean, you have E3 and Jurassic World. Game of Thrones actually is not the lead story on White Noise this week, which is crazy for a finale week.
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous.
Although I guess now it is a lead story at this moment since I just brought it up, but we'll come back to it later.
I'll talk about E3. I just finished the E3 recap show with Brian. For all those listening to Weekly, go check it out. It's great. And I realized while preparing for that show that I've watched about, 9 to 10 hours of press conferences, which is something I would never do for anything else other than EA. But I've seen every single press conference they had at E3, and... Yeah, wow, my eyes are a little tired still, actually. I probably should go outside or something.
Nah, it's fun. I mean, I like this time of year. It's, part of it's because it's summer. I have the time to indulge in most of this stuff. I'm not sure what that's supposed to mean. If that's some kind of commentary on my life, I won't take it. But, no, I mean, I always like this time of year. E3 is always, I'm trying to think. There's definitely equivalents in other walks of life, but, I mean, the fact... This is where everyone gets together. Everyone talks about the things that they love, and everyone gets excited. And it's just something I'm really happy for, and to see the future, so to speak.
Future. What was the advertising thing you had, David, about the future?
What do you mean by that? About the future?
Like you're advertising for Halo 5. What was it?
About Halo 5 in the future? I can't exactly remember. I'm sure it was something incredibly
it was like
clever.
Anything is possible or something. I don't remember.
Anything is possible.
Is this going to be the Halo where they replace Jonah Hill with Seth Rogen?
Anything is possible in Halo 5.
Halo
what does that mean? What does that mean? What does that mean? That's what I said during the press conference, and Seth gave me a hard time.
Yeah, no, because you were just like, they were talking about it.
I was just geeking out. I was just geeking out because, I love Halo.
And then they said, Halo 5 anything is possible, man. Like,
and I was like, guys, they said anything is possible. What does that mean?
Like, you were so existentially distraught. I don't even understand.
Where did we come from? Why are we here, guys? What is the meaning of
what
life?
Is
Halo. Halo is the meaning of life, guys. Join us.
So, I love E3, and to a certain degree, I think this might be the last year I'm not at E3 until I get poor again, from whatever happens at each job.
You're going
but
to buy
I want
one
to go
ticket
to...
for E3, and it's only going to be one day. It's not going to be the weekly pass. It's just going to be one day.
I'll take Monday. Great. I kind of have to go to every Bethesda press conference after the one we just saw. But I guess not a Fallout game won't be coming out for a while. Neither same with the Elder Scrolls games.
You might be able to make Fallout 7 at one point in time.
But I would love to go there because it's such a spectacle. There's all those game demos and get to see all the different booths, all the different events. We only get to see the press conferences, but while that was going on, you had the YouTube live streaming was introduced new games. That's the only time I saw Tony Hawk, the new Tony Hawk Pro Skater 5, was during the YouTube live, which I was barely even watching. I was like, oh, wow, Tony Hawk's there. Wow, he's old.
Yeah, he looks like the Crypt Keeper.
Do you guys know who Bob Burnquist is?
Of course I do.
That guy's 45, and he's actually still skating. He's Tony Hawk.
He's from Brazil. He was in the original Tony Hawk Pro Skater. He was the only one of the few guys in Tony Hawk Pro Skater 1 through 4.
Well, and he's the only one still skating today. I saw him, he got bronze on an X Games event or something. It's kind of funny that, he's the guy that goes to, the skate park. Hey, guys, how are you doing?
Y'all are so excited about the Tony Hawk Pro Skater game, but, look at the EA press conference. I mean, you got to listen to Pele give his memoirs for 15 minutes.
But I was inspired. That was EA's whole thing, right? They want things that inspire.
We mentioned that EA had the worst press conference. I really want to go back to Tony Hawk real quick. Did anyone else play Pro Skater 1 and just use Rune Glyphberg and use the Christ there and get, like, impossible amount of points? So that's what I did as a kid.
I did many things with that game, all to the tune of Goldfinger by Superman by Goldfinger.
Here I am. Yeah. Older all the time. I love that. I love that song. The soundtrack's always great. Anyways, you're right. The EA, they did have, you know, Pele out there. They went too long about NBA Live. What was his name? The Hoops God?
Yeah, Hoops God.
The Hoops God, that's right. I mean, Pele was on there, and it looked like it was a Sports Center segment that was going on. And like Seth actually brought up during the press conference, "Where's Tom Rinaldi during this press conference?" Like, when is he going to ask the family questions and, you know, the emotional questions and you know, cause the audience members to cry? I mean, it was a really odd situation.
And look, in a vacuum, I'd love to hear an interview with Pele because I'm sure that'd be pretty cool. But I don't really, you know, want that when I'm waiting for Star Wars Battlefront, for instance.
It's also the fact it was like near the end, you just went through, like, we already listened to sports for a while, some weird stuff, like a lot of time on Plants for Zombies 2. I will say, though, what was the game called? Unravel? We were making fun of Unravel at first.
You were making fun of Unravel. Me and Brian were just like, that looks cool.
No,
I was making fun of it too.
I had it for number two of my best EA games. I'm really excited for, you know, new IP. And it was just kind of like, okay, well, I was at the river over there, and that's when the game came to be. And here's me carrying around yarn everywhere. Here's yarn on the mountain. And, yeah, that was a little ridiculous. No,
the guy's story was crazy, but, I mean, the game itself looks fantastic.
Awesome, yeah.
Yeah. I do kind of wonder where the idea for this game came from. Was it, you know, some guy who took his cat to the wilderness for a week, you know, tripped on some acid and watched his cat play with a ball of yarn and was like...
It was a family camping trip.
And his cat was playing with a ball of yarn while he was on acid, and he goes, you know what, Yarn Man would make a great game, and we'll call it Unraveled, and it'll be a man running around making a trampoline out of his head of yarn and hopping around platform to platform, and it looked awesome, honestly. Like, it was a great looking game. It was a kind of a neat looking platform with an excellent art style.
Yeah, and you know, eureka moments have come from Stranger Things, but you know, to be quite honest, I think it's really kind of sad and indicative of what EA actually didn't do, that this is the thing that we're talking about, the EA pressure.
Yeah, that was the thing that stood out.
And maybe I didn't stick around for long enough, but like I wanted to see more of Mass Effect 4, or Mass Effect Andromeda, as it's now called.
Yeah.
And all we got was really, what, a 45-second teaser trailer?
Well, it's okay. They're going to announce the Collector's Edition, which comes in three different colors. You have the red color... The green color.
You got your renegade color and your paragon color.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Now. And the middle option, which I was not good enough to unlock, unfortunately, because, you know, I don't know what I did. Mass Effect
kicking someone out of a window.
Yeah, I know Mass Effect 2, I didn't collect enough planet parts or whatever in mining to, which I don't know why you did it, David.
And I'm honestly, so the choice of game that you pick will have no impact whatsoever on the finale of the game.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't matter. But the other thing I will say about EA real quick, I don't remember EA being this bad overall, though. Even though they've always had sports stuff, I've usually enjoyed the EA press conferences more. So I'm not really sure what it was about this one that made it so much worse. But I did kind of enjoy watching the guy walk out there with the zombie head, even if it was weird. I was like, okay, zombie head. I like that. I want one of those now for some reason.
I think a lot of the reason is because of some of the other press conferences that we saw. And really, the best of the best conference out of them all might have been the first one.
The Bethesda
one. You know, showing off new Doom, showing off Fallout 4. I mean, EA just, you know, can't even get a break when compared to that.
And was EA Access shown during Microsoft, or was it shown during
Microsoft, which is probably
the best. And so that was their biggest thing. That was their biggest announcement that I heard probably out of all their announcements during EA, was the one during Microsoft. So that kind of stole some of the thunder that EA had going into their conference.
Well, we already had EA Access as always a thing, but having it free this week, I've already started playing UFC because it's free this week for members of Gold, and I made a guy who was 5'6", 150 pounds, who was super fat with chest hair. His name was Esposito. So, you know, I really enjoyed the UFC character customization already.
So a little Gus Fring shout-out there by you.
Yeah,
Giancarlo Esposito was the actor for Gus Fring. But
I wanted to be a Stevez. But they did not have that last name as one they could, like, voice, so I went Esposito.
you wanted him to say, you know, Hey, Stevez! Otherwise, not really worth it.
I was going to be the Tasmanian Devil, but then I went with Bam Bam as my nickname. So
that's what is it? I think it's like one of the old 2K14, NBA 2K14, where, you know, if they didn't have your name, you had to pick one or whatever. You know, and there's Big Daddy with the ball at the top of the key.
I was Goose. Goose with the three.
Or like, but, and like one of them was like the Natural. It's just like...
But you made a good point, though. Like, EA was kind of a sandwich between, in my opinion, the best four press conferences were, in some order, Bethesda, Microsoft, Ubisoft, and Sony. EA was sandwiched between all five of those other four press conferences, which is kind of why it looks so lackluster. But let's talk about the other one. So Microsoft had probably the coolest thing that I'm not sure will work for anything but Minecraft really well, but the HoloLens thing was incredible.
Yeah, I'm not ready to embrace that, man. I think we're still a ways away, but it was really eye-opening and breathtaking.
And if you Seth, if you read about some of this, if you read about some of the stories online about some of the I guess reporters' interactions with the HoloLens, I mean, I remember I read Ryan McCarthy from IGN actually played Halo 5 with the HoloLens, and they had some sort of cinematic where he actually was talking about how it felt and how it really did feel like you were a part of the Halo universe, and how HoloLens really does kind of feel like it's going to be one of those implements into gaming that's going to actually kind of impact the future and kind of what Microsoft wanted Kinect to be, which Kinect turned out to be a huge failure. So it's going to be interesting to see HoloLens, how Microsoft is continuing to kind of try to push the fold of gaming and how gamers are going to react to this. Are they going to embrace the idea of playing that kind of third dimension of gaming, or are they going to reject it like Kinect, which kind of seemed to dull down gaming and turn it into more of a casual experience than gamers really wanted?
Well, I think in an industry that's consistently going toward VR, I like the fact that Microsoft's doing something different. And like I said, I just want to play God. So I want, you know, David, you be playing Halo 5 in some very tough multiplayer match. Maybe you're about to win. And I'm like, lightning strike! And then I kill you.
You're going to strike my Spartan to death. You're going to smite my Spartan.
That's exactly what I want to do with that, which I don't know. Maybe I'm an evil ruler. I don't know, wannabe. I don't know. But that's what I was most excited about. And also the fact that like, you could have like Forge. Imagine Forge being kind of controlled through the HoloLens.
No, it would be fascinating, for sure. I mean, it's definitely an element of gaming that I'm interested to see how it unfolds. It's something that I feel like most gamers aren't going to be exactly eager, you know, biting at the tooth to buy immediately. And it's going to be something that's going to have to really earn its place in gaming. And if it's legit, and you hear a lot of great reviews about it, and you see one of your friends playing it, and it looks amazing, you're going to want to buy it then. But you're not going to be maybe one of those guys in the frontier that goes out there and buys yourself a HoloLens immediately.
Oh, I think, Seth, you're the one who said this. It's going to be funny, though, like when you have the HoloLens, and it's like someone walks into the room when you're using it, and like, you're just like hovering around like a desk that's empty.
Yeah. No, I mean,
just grasping at air.
It looks like it has some potential. I'm not sure, you know, the industry is ready for a thing like that. I mean, the closest comparison I can think of is like Google Glass, for instance. You know, the price tag is almost going to be, you know, almost certainly going to be insurmountable. It's going to, you know, need some mass adoption to even catch on. And Google Glass has had those issues and is, you know, we don't use the term failure in industry. We use disappointment. So it'll be interesting. I don't think they have, you know, their eyes, you know, I don't think their ambition is that high for this thing. It's just more a neat gadget. And I don't think that they came off, you know, saying this is going to change everything. This is like, hey, this is what we've been working on. I think they framed it in a way that was, you know, showed their intentions.
Well,
if that makes sense. And if
I'm going to dream, but not like Sony's dreams. Those
you
are
mean
terrifying.
More of a nightmare?
those are absolutely terrifying.
Oh,
so another thing I'm really excited about from the Microsoft press conference, backwards compatibility, which isn't huge right away. And a lot of the games aren't even come out till holiday. I think they said they'll have 100 by holiday. Right now there's 21, which is mostly like rare games. And Mass Effect 1, which I'm going to install pretty soon. But
Halo
it is
Reach.
Exciting because... Yeah, it's exciting because I don't need my 360, and David and Seth, you guys don't even have an Xbox 360 that can start playing Xbox 360 games.
Yeah, it's the kind of interesting thing that I got in a rant with one of my buddies about this, is that this is a game changer in a way that I don't think it's really fair to say, just because Sony in the past gen, you know, the arms race between Xbox, or as my friend affectionately calls it, Xbone, and... And Sony has been really chronicled, and backwards compatibility has always been something that's defined it, I think. I think the Xbox 360 was backwards compatible.
A list of original Xbox games that could work, including Halo 2.
And you know, Sony's always kind of had trouble with backwards compatibility. So the only reason I think that this is a game changer is because I don't think Sony's close.
Also, to think the Sony, they have their streaming service. This is a huge slap in the face, their expensive streaming service to play old games. Xbox, Microsoft's just like, okay, do you have it? Just put it in. Or you can just, you know, buy these games. It's not entirely streaming-based. I don't know, it's huge. I have a bazillion 360 games that I was really not going to want to bring wherever I go. There's a, you know, I don't want to take up that much storage having all these games. Or maybe there's a game I missed that I want to play. Like I said, you guys are really going to benefit from this. It's also kind of a thing where if you haven't decided between Xbox One or PS4, Xbox 360 was the popular American, you know, console comparatively.
Well, and all the people, people who are holding off on buying their Xbox One because they don't want to get rid of their, you know, Xbox 360, they're going to buy an Xbox One now.
I mean, it's fascinating to me because this feels like something that's been extremely underplayed by the gaming media. So, you know, online, when you've been looking at the blogs, you know, like IGN, game trailers, this is something that's been extremely underplayed when you're looking at who won E3, so to speak. I mean, that's something that we've been talking about. It's kind of an interesting conversation because it's hard to pinpoint who actually wins E3. But this is something that's been kind of underplayed and not really gotten a bunch of exposure. I mean, when you looked at when Microsoft presented it during the conference, it was something that's just kind of like swept under the rug. It was like given, what, like 2 minutes of airtime during the actual press conference. And this is something that's kind of a game changer because when you're looking at PlayStation 4, they don't have any backwards compatibility. You have to go use their online service and buy the games again. And when you look at Microsoft, they're allowing you to have backwards compatibility and was kind of underplayed when it was something that could have been really a big trump card during this press conference. And it's been kind of an afterthought now.
Let me kind of clarify. I don't think that Sony is completely far and away from it, but the thing is, I don't think the software can do it. I think that's why it's so huge that Xbox came out with it.
Well, I don't think... So last generation, PS3 had a lot of trouble with certain games, which includes Skyrim, because it was a very high-tech performance console, but it had a lot of adaptability problems. It wasn't very flexible to a certain degree, and actually had a lot of issues with the software. Microsoft's been very fascinating to me because they've kind of done a complete 180 from the 2013, you know, press conference about everything to what they are now. The hard drive's completely different. And we're looking at a, you know, console that's going to be able to run Windows 10 on PC, tablet, or the game console. You can play the same games. Now 360 is going to be coming to this interface. That's really adaptable, and that's kind of huge, in my opinion, the versatility you're going to have with this compared to PS4, which we don't even know if they're going to be able to do that. It doesn't seem like they're going to have the same kind of backwards compatibility. It might just be the streaming service, which is still a huge work in progress.
Yeah, but it'll be interesting to see. I mean, obviously, I'm really excited because, as you already said, Billy, I never owned an Xbox 360. This is going to put a lot of games in my hand.
No, it's fantastic.
And David can play
you.
Halo Reach now. He can play every Halo game.
I can play literally every Halo game now, and I can also replay Fallout 3 before I actually get the remastered edition with my Fallout 4.
What a great segue, David. So we've spent too much time on E3 because there's a lot to talk about. But the last thing I want to do before we get to, I think, our favorite, just real quick, we'll say our favorite two or three games we saw. So Fallout 4, I love Fallout 3. It was my favorite game of probably ever.
You get nominated into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I know it's Hall of Fame. And the intro video was really cool. And then they showed a little gameplay and stuff. It was great. And then they went to, you know, the Fallout shelter. Okay, and then they go back to it. So you have the coolest customization, you know, tear apart the world, whatever you want to call it, house, civilization building stuff I've ever seen in an open, you know, Western RPG, which is all optional. Then you have the deepest gun customization I've ever seen. You can customize your own power armor. Oh, and then you have jetpacks, too. Every single moment of that, you know, trailer they introduced, or the gameplay footage they showed, just got better and better and better. And this game, I already said it on the other show, but we have, before Fallout, every game that comes out before Fallout, I'm putting in one list. And then every game that comes out after Fallout 4, I'm playing another list. And then for another 4 months, because I can't play anything else for 4 months after Fallout 4, and that's ignoring the mods you're going to have.
Yeah, you're going to get
so
PC
I really could
mods,
never be
too,
done with
which
this
is
game.
Huge
yeah.
news.
I could never be done with this game, really.
You could basically recreate Fallout 5 on Fallout 4, not even buy Fallout 5. You could just call it Fallout 4 5 Edition.
And it comes with Fallout 3, which is, I guess, the new thing we're going to see. All the Xbox One people are going to be like, I mean, Xbox One games are going to come with the older one, which is going to be kind of a fascinating way of value. They're going to add it to this.
I mean, it definitely was kind of the standout game to me when I was looking at the games that were presented during E3. It was a game that was playable. It was a game that had a ton of customization. Very impressive. It was definitely a next-generation game. And, I mean, when you're looking big picture at what this conference brought to us and what, you know, E3 brought to us as a whole, next-gen-wise, I see a ton of customization, massive environments, being able to pull off a lot of, you know, a lot of different elements of the entire gaming experience when you're looking at campaigns, when you're looking at multiplayer, when you're looking at, you know, like a Forge thing from Halo, and being able to implement that all into one game time in one seamless environment for gaming. The gaming future is bright, I would say, looking after this E3 2015. And when you put, you know, the things that Microsoft presented through HoloLens, what PS4 did for their own version of that, it's definitely it seems to be sort of a turning point in gaming right now. And we're going to be getting a lot more next-gen games. This is the time that you really want to buy a new console, I would say, things are going to start turning next-gen.
2015, I think, was when the next-gen was truly supposed to take off. I think that's something that Brian and I kind of agreed
on. So essentially, there's a thing where, like, somewhere between 2 and 3 years after the console launch is really when it takes off. We saw that last time. That's 2007, I think, was like the big year, and 2008 was another huge year. So Witcher 3 is probably the closest thing I've seen to a next-gen game. Arkham Knight, I'm sure, will be like that. But like a lot of ways, GTA 5 was kind of like the beacon, and that's, again, it came out in 2013. That's kind of something where all these games are to come out this fall and next spring are going to be huge
in
the industry.
Which is strange, because GTA 5 basically pushed the last gen to its limit, and the only real difference between it and the new gen is, you know, a couple of shaders, probably.
Yeah, but it's incredible still.
Developers are finally being able to really grasp this technology and push it to its limits, which is just really exciting for a game.
And developers are starting to have faith in it, which is, you know, always the hardest thing to do when you've got a system like this.
So real quick, because like I said, we spent too much time on this, but just say, I guess, one game that you're really excited about that we haven't mentioned yet. You can go ahead, Seth, first.
I'll go ahead and I'm really excited for Doom. The Doom looks really cool.
Hell yeah.
Really, really cool. That's all I can really say. I'm sad that I can only mention one. Uncharted 4 is another one that I would love to mention. But no, Doom looks like it looks much in the vein of Mortal Kombat. It looks like something that's not going to flirt with you. It's not going to do much. It's just, you know, mindless, senseless entertainment. And ultimately, that's what we play video games for. Sometimes you need something like this, and Doom looks like it takes it an extra level and adds some wrinkles to what already is a pretty fun way to play video games.
Also, it's a hell of a customization for the multiplayer in terms of the ability to be able to
do. Some of the map building stuff just got me all, you know, I grew up on Warcraft 3 being my gateway video game, and you know, I spent hours upon hours on the map editor trying to, you know, make a map that, you know, me and my dad could play on, and the, you know, that type of map, you know, if with the right set of friends, I mean, we just try and kill each other, you know, make maps that'll kill each other. I mean, that seems like a lot of fun to me.
All right, what about you, David?
I mean, it's kind of tough for me, and obviously, I mean, Halo 5 was a little bit underwhelming during its presentation, but then when you look at what they did with the Warzone, when you saw some of the multiplayer demos, it really stood out to me and looks like it's going to be a really fun game multiplayer-wise. It does a lot of things the other Halos weren't able to do. And then you also look at, you know, the Final Fantasy VII remake coming out and what that's going to be like on the next gen, a classic game that I've never been able to play. And it's announced that it's coming to PS4 first only, which might mean I might actually have some hope as an Xbox One owner to actually get to play a Final Fantasy game. So I'm really excited about that. I know they had some games that came out in the past on the Xbox 360, but Final Fantasy VII is kind of the tentpole Final Fantasy game, so I'm excited about that. But the game that really stood out to me, I guess, that we haven't mentioned was Horizon for the PS4, which is a game I'm not going to be able to probably play since it's not coming to the Xbox One.
David, just come hang on me.
But that game looks really fascinating to me. I mean, it's, you got, you know, a free roaming kind of environment, tons of detail. It looks really next gen to me. And then you have mechanical dinosaurs, which I like dinosaurs, as we'll talk about during Jurassic World. But I mean, Horizon looks like a true next gen free roaming game to me. And I'm really excited to see what they do with that game. And it might actually convince me to maybe cough up some cash and buy a PS4 at a later date.
Refresh my memory. Did we see anything about Final Fantasy 15? Or is that in Square Enix?
It did not show up either at all. Square Enix actually was kind of interesting where they did. They had Final Fantasy, I guess, World or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think Horizon Zero Dawn, in a press conference that had The Last Guardian, which was, you know, long-awaited but slightly underwhelming, and you had Uncharted 4, which looked awesome, what I knew about it. There was a lot of third-party games within that press conference, which is kind of the Microsoft approach of old, which is kind of interesting, you know, reversal. Microsoft was more first-party, and Sony had a lot of third-party support. But Horizon Zero Dawn was probably the coolest new IP I've seen of the entire E3, and I'm really excited about that game as well. For me, there's a lot of games I probably like more than the one I'm going to mention, but I don't even care, because we already went over, you know, some of the other ones that I love, like Doom or Halo 5 or Fallout 4, so I'm going with Cuphead. Cuphead's awesome.
Yeah.
Cuphead, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, it's like a game that, like, with a, you know, 1920s, 30s
Disney,
you know,
cartoon
Mickey
kind
Mouse.
Of thing.
Yeah, Disney
Steam,
cartoon
Steamboat
Mickey Mouse
Willie
animation
type
style.
Stuff.
Yeah, animation style that has, you know, they like these two cups play craps against the devil and lose. So in order for them not get their souls taken by him, they agree to make a deal with the devil and work for him. And you have so many different elements of classic games in the most unique art style I've ever seen. And I don't know, it's just going to be great. I'm really excited about it. I love the way that it's going to combine a bunch of different 2D platformers from the, you know, kind of you're like a spaceship type deal, you know, shooting a big enemy, which you've seen in a lot of games, or just a pure 2D platformer. I'm really pumped for that.
I mean,
game.
It takes your expectations of what next gen's supposed to be, and it turns it on its head. So that's a really fascinating approach to take on these new consoles.
It's like a Shovel Knight. You know, Shovel Knight was a phenomenal game because it's a 2D game at heart that has next gen capabilities. You've been playing Pillars of Autumn. What's it called? Pillars of Autumn, the Halo level. Yeah, Pillars of Eternity, which is another game that's kind of similar, where it's today's technology for an old school game.
Well, it's a good way of putting it. I mean, it's really throwback, and it doesn't rely on tricks so much as doing the old tricks to the best of their capabilities.
All right, well, we got to move on. So, David, the biggest Jurassic Park fan I've ever met in my life, talk about Jurassic World for us.
I mean, it's a return to a type of movie that, you know, I've been waiting to see for a long time. It has a ton of nostalgia, a ton of, you know, just kind of that sense of wonder that Jurassic Park brought to the screen when I was a child. It kind of brought back that kind of feeling of me as a kid when I was watching this movie. And Jurassic Park was the type of movie that really kind of brought me as a fan into movies and had me looking into film and really kind of appreciating it and what film could bring as an experience for the viewer. And Jurassic World's not a perfect movie by any stretch of the imagination. It has a ton of flaws. The writing is not particularly sharp in terms of the dialogue. The characters are one-dimensional, but within the frame of what it's trying to do and kind of bring back that kind of Spielbergian magic that the movies used to bring from like the time of the 70s and the 80s and kind of that feeling that Spielberg brought of wonder, like I mentioned, Jurassic World really does a good job of bringing that back, and I really did appreciate this movie. And it's probably my second favorite movie I've seen this year after Mad Max Fury Road. It's a movie I'd probably give it a B-plus on the David scale because it does have a lot of flaws, but what it does with the sense of wonder it brings, kind of bringing that inner child out of you, and really kind of really doing a lot of fan service to fans of the franchise that kind of got shafted in the past by the previous sequels. I was a fan of the Lost World Jurassic Park, but it definitely had a lot of flaws. And if I was... And as a hardcore fan of, you know, the first movie, it didn't really reach that kind of pinnacle. And this one doesn't either, but it does a really good job of making up for the problems they've had with the sequels in the past.
With the biggest Hollywood star right now, and Chris Pratt.
Yeah, absolutely. The Chris Pratt.
The fat guy from Parks and Rec ends up being the biggest Hollywood star we have right now. And blockbuster movies.
From fat boy from Parks and Rec to Hollywood hunk.
Yeah, and I love him in Parks and Rec, so that's... I guess I'm not surprised how great he ended up being, but... So there's two interesting things, I guess, about the opening. One, neither me or Seth even saw the movie that broke the box office record.
It has me thinking, who saw this movie? Are they doing ticket fraud?
Maybe.
I mean, who are going to see these showings of this movie that it broke the record?
I'll see it, like, Thursday. I'm sure Seth will see it soon. We'll probably do a spoiler draft
on it. I was going to watch it on Tuesday, but then, like, something was in my food, and I didn't really feel like it. And then the Microsoft presser was on, and I wanted to catch that, so... You know, it's just a couple events conspired, and I was going to watch it, then I wasn't going to watch it, and it's just...
He meant Monday. He forgot the days because he was so sick from that food.
But even though y'all haven't seen it, I mean, we have, like, we can talk about maybe of its impact that it has on this franchise, which was really kind of at a turning point in its existence. I mean, they hadn't had a movie that came out in more than a decade. And this movie was supposed to stand up and really kind of turn it around and rebrand Jurassic Park as a viable franchise in the modern day. And obviously, it's done a successful job. More than a successful job.
I see a deal with Activision to put in their Skylander series. I see a new trilogy to be announced very soon. They're going to make a bazillion more of these things. They're going to make as much as possible. Because, like I said, I can't believe how many people love this movie. Not love this movie, but went to go see it. And... I don't know, I thought this movie was going to be a huge disappointment, but the reviews, you know, 59 Metacritic, which is, you know, that's good.
It's an average movie. That's like an average
summer
blockbuster.
That's not even average. That's above average.
That means that chances are you meet a guy, they're going to like it.
Yeah, 70% Rotten Tomatoes. Like I said, way better than I thought this was going to get. And really, the way the box office, like I said, number one all-time opening weekend is huge. I mean, Avengers Age of Ultron's one of the highest ever recently. Furious 7, one of the highest ever opening weekends. Which makes me wonder, a question you've asked, how will Star Wars do at the end this year?
Break it.
This is an insult to Jurassic Park. You are insulting Jurassic Park right now by bringing up Star Wars after Jurassic World comes out. We've been giving it appreciation. But,
Jurassic Park, Jurassic Park is a 90s franchise. Star Wars is a 90s, 80s, 70s, 2000s franchise. It's simple mathematics that suggests it's going to be better.
Better in terms of box office accruing?
Everything.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm the biggest Jurassic Park fan. I grew up on Jurassic Park. I didn't grow up on Star Wars. So I'm kind of have a little bit of a skewed
viewpoint
on this.
I'm not saying that you grew up on Star Wars. I'm saying your dad did.
I'm saying everyone did. I did. I love Jurassic Park. Jurassic Park was great, but I can't say Jurassic Park had the impact that Star Wars had.
I mean, I'm not going to argue that, obviously, but I think if you're looking at how Star Wars is going to do in the box office, I mean, the obvious answer is that it's going to do better, and it's going to break every record in the book. This is a movie that, you know, after the prequels, really had a disappointing following. People were disappointed with how Star Wars turned out. It still made a ton of money, obviously. But now you got J.J. Abrams, a guy who's a director that's liked a lot by a lot of fans, and like casually as well. He brought back Star Trek. You know, he brought back Star Trek. You know, he was kind of the father of Lost, which, you know, had a really huge following, and now he's bringing back Star Wars, and Disney's behind it. I mean, there's a lot of recipe for this movie to do excellent in the box office, but I am kind of interested to see how this being a winter opening is going to affect the box office turnout, at least in that first weekend. I think that it will definitely break the record overall for the most money brought in for a movie franchise. But in that first 3 days, how is this going to do compared to, you know, the Jurassic World opening, which came out in the middle of summer? Kids are out of school. I mean, kids are out of school during the winter as well, but you don't have a holiday of Christmas being around. During Christmas, I mean, what do you think of? Do you think I'm going to go see Star Wars on Christmas?
Yes.
I mean, it's something that's interesting to me. People usually – Christmas is a family holiday where people are usually being at their homes and visiting with their families. They're not going to the movies. So I'm interested to see how this impacts. What, do you go to the movies on Christmas? Do you go, oh,
it's
Christmas
time? It's not Christmas. It comes out December 18th, okay? It's the winter break. I'm going to be home with family, and I'm going to go see Star Wars the day it comes out, if not, like, the day before or whatever. I think, like, I didn't see Jurassic World. Seth didn't see Jurassic World. I know a lot of people who saw it, but also a lot of people didn't see it. Everyone I know, for the most part, is going to see Star Wars when it comes out.
I mean, obviously, I'm playing Dino's advocate, and I'm trying to put out an interesting conversation here, and it's not working because we all know that Star Wars is going. We all know that Star Wars is going to own the box office record, but what would cause it not to own the box office record is an interesting thought, at least.
Not being Star Wars.
I don't know the winter argument doesn't really work for me, because that's one that I'm thinking everyone's going to be home. There's no excuse for anyone to watch this. No one's going to say, I've got to go to work. I mean, that's, you know, for this one, at least you can say that some of the adults are going to go to work. And you know, the other thing, too, this is the only movie that came out this weekend. You know, it wasn't really competing with anything, and that's kind of why it did so well, and Star Wars is in the same boat. And look, I'm going to see this movie, and, you know, it's going to be a great movie. It's nice that it accomplished this, but it's the kind of thing that, like, it's like the NFL passing record where, you know, everyone's going to break it, you know, every year after year, because everything's just trending that way.
And you also got inflation going on.
Yeah.
You got inflation going on, so obviously the price is going to continue to rise over time, and more movies are going to break other movies. There will be records that are broken constantly. I still think it's an incredible accomplishment for this movie just made. And I don't think we should, you know, undermine the actual accomplishment that this movie did in breaking
the
record.
Best way to put it. So Jurassic World, like I said, the greatest, biggest opening ever, $524 million, and second is 400. I'm looking at one that's like worldwide opening.
It was 208 million to like 207 million or something like that.
So it's biggest worldwide, but also biggest opening 3 day weekend. Jurassic World's the biggest inflation.
They broke the Dark Knight today, with the record for, you know, a non-holiday Monday opening.
Anyways, so pretty much, if you're looking at the list of, like, biggest box office openings ever, you know, for U.S. and Canada, which is, like, you know, 3 day weekend, 2015, 2012, 2015, 2013, 2011, 2012, 2008, 2013, 2012, and then 2007, 2015 again. Like, it's just more movies coming out. These blockbusters are going to break the records of previous blockbusters. It's just surprising Jurassic World was the one that did it.
No, I mean, I completely agree. I mean, it's really a quite the accomplishment, but it's something that's going to be broken eventually. But it's good to see this franchise resurrected from kind of a pivotal point in its time. And it's good to see dinosaurs rule the Earth for at least a little bit before Star Wars comes around and knocks it off its perch.
David loves his Jurassic Park. It's like his. It's like I said, that's the movie where, for the Hall of Fame, you're upset we couldn't have Jurassic Park.
And it's interesting to see Colin Trevorrow, the director of Jurassic World, was talking about how he wants to make Jurassic Park a franchise on the level of Marvel Universe and a franchise on the level of the Star Wars Universe. And how is he going to be able to pull this off? I don't think he really can, because Jurassic Park's kind of a single storyline kind of thing. There's not really an expanded universe.
Well, that's a good segue, though. I will say that Marvel had a very nice gesture to Jurassic World and them breaking their record.
No, I mean, it has a great little picture here of, you know, the T-Rex holding the hammer of Thor and Chris Pratt slash Star-Lord. They're kind of doing advertising for themselves here, but they're doing it in a nice way. Having, you know, Star-Lord on the back of T-Rex in front of the Marvel Avengers looking on.
Yeah, it was a pretty cool picture. I like seeing, like, the Hulk, like, mad, like, you know, little tornado thing over his head, cartoonish thing, and Thor was confused, and, you know, it was nice.
It's the background of my phone now, I'm not going to lie. I like it. It's cool. I mean, I love that picture. It's the background on my phone.
Did it replace Master Chief, or...
It replaced the Breaking Bad Season 4 background with, you know, with Jesse Pinkman and his little being puppeted by Walter White and Gus Fring. It definitely had to overcome a lot to replace that, because I love that.
How is it not? I still understand why it's not the poster I have of Walter White, All Hail the King, with the money. That's the best Breaking Bad picture. You know it is.
I mean, it is. I like little cartoonish elements to my picture, though, I'll say.
So, looks like we've already, you know, like we're pretty far into the podcast, 40 something minutes in. This is perfect. We can't spend too much time talking about my least favorite Game of Thrones episode in a long time. Whew, that's good.
Yeah, it's strange because, you know, we've been spending a lot of time on our podcast, the majority of the time, talking about the Game of Thrones episode and our reaction from various, you know, from each episode. And then this week you had two, you know, massive releases with Jurassic World coming out and breaking all the records and surprising us all. And then you had, you know, the E3 conference as well. And Game of Thrones has slipped to our, you know, our third story here, but it's still massive news. I mean, Game of Thrones definitely delivered in terms of what's happening to the franchise and how they're changing the series, but the reaction between us three is definitely a little bit mixed. I know Seth and I had a little bit of a conversation here beforehand of what happened in the finale, how this impacts us and our relation to the series, and it's still a series that is definitely a very good series and above the standard of television, and I don't think we should really diminish the accomplishments of the previous episodes, but this episode in particular to me definitely surprised me in a bad way.
Well, let's so Seth, you like this episode the most, so I'll let you go first.
It's
disliked
it
the least.
That's probably a better way of putting it. I mean, and you kind of said it best when we were talking about it, Billy, is that, you know, what happened, I think, I'm behind almost everything that happened. So there were some, you know, storytelling snafus and some, you know, writing issues and just kind of pacing and all this, that, and the other thing. But, like, in terms of what's happened and, you know, this is everything that's consistent. And, it's, you know, I didn't walk away and I wasn't watching this, you know, thinking this is absolutely terrible. And you know, there are some scenes that felt a little out of odds. The Marcella scene with Jamie felt – I liked that scene a lot. But, you know, when it ended, I'm just like kind of, oh, this injected some drama into something I didn't really care about. And while I appreciate that intent – hell, I even like that intent. I like that, you know, all this time wasted in Dorne wasn't actually time wasted. But at the same time, you know, it did feel kind of forced at times in its own weird way. But
it was kind of hokey, but enforced, and yet it worked. It was weird how that happened.
To me, it was just insane coincidences. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Seth.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying that, you know, everything made sense. Nothing came out of left field, and nothing was really done in a way that was a cardinal sin. I don't think that this is the worst Game of Thrones episode I've ever seen. Frankly, I don't think this makes Game of Thrones something that's not worth watching.
No. I think the I'm kind of in middle ground here. I don't know.
When David and I talked, you know, David's like, yeah, you know, I like to think of myself in the middle ground. Billy, well, I'm the middle ground now. And, like, you know, I'm the only one that liked it. And now people are getting closer and closer to where I'm at, it appears.
No. I think you've fallen more, in my opinion. That's how I like to see it. here's my thoughts, okay? My dislike of this episode, okay, is not because the episode was horrible or anything. I could maybe argue it was below average episode of television. But there's a couple of cardinal sins. One, season 4 was so incredibly done, in my opinion.
That's
probably
not
the
a
best
sin, though.
Ever. Listen. Season 4 was so incredibly done. Probably the best we'll ever get out of the fantasy genre in a massive scale, right? So what we associate Game of Thrones with, and the way I view Game of Thrones is kind of the same way I view Breaking Bad, right? Where every episode was a huge treat that I was really looking forward to every week, and which is why partially we talked about every single week, you know, on the weekly, because Game of Thrones is a special show. And this season, overall, kind of did its best to ruin that special feel, but no episode did it better at ruining it than, you know, Mother's Mercy episode 10, because the way they resolve so many storylines and the pacing issues, like, why build up Stannis in season 2 to kind of ruin a storyline in 2 episodes with an ambiguous ending that didn't make sense? You know, why are we going to spend so much time with, you know, Theon and Sansa in these horrible situations to kind of a weird ending with who cares about Miranda and then they're ripping off the wall? Like, I didn't really kind of get that. It was kind of weird. Why make a big deal about this battle at Winterfell to just kind of rush through and probably the worst fight scene if it wasn't for that one with the Red Viper, not the Red Viper, but the Sand Snakes we already had. And then why do we still, like, you know, Marcella, you know, dying, I think, or having poison. I'm not sure if she dies, but on that whole scene, you know, why do we have that? Like, well, I don't know. I don't know why Larry's part. The only really scene I was really happy with this entire time was Arya infiltrating the brothel and killing, you know, Ser Manny Trant. But even then, right?
What about
the scene
Cersei?
After that with Jaqen. Well, the scene after with, I'll get to that one in a second. The scene after with Jaqen, right? But why, last episode, we spent a ridiculous amount of time with Arya being super conspicuous watching him, and it was kind of weird. This one was done super quickly, and then you have Cersei in probably a scene that could have been better if it wasn't as long and annoying to a certain degree, with the shame, and it just went on forever. It was really weird pacing for the whole thing. I didn't quite understand, like, I feel like I could have done the season from a pure pacing or just moving scenes to certain parts. It could have been done way better, and they just, I don't know, they just, like, they wanted to put every big event in the finale, and they did that, and it made the episode worse for it.
I'm going to go ahead and state the obvious here and say that we're not going to really know the true impact of what happened this season until we see the next season, because everything ended on some sort of cliffhanger. And depending on how season 6 opens and tells us how these stories are resolved, such as if Stannis is really dead, if Jon Snow is really dead, but that doesn't really – but you still have to look at the season if we're reviewing the season on its own merits, and Billy's right. The pacing was very off, in my opinion. And then you have a bunch of elements in this single episode that are supposed to be really heavy, impactful at moments, but the fact that they're all jam-packed together and none of them are given their due time to really give us some sort of feeling of impact from them and emotional resonance really diminishes the episode as a whole to me. And, I mean, it definitely is probably in my bottom 5 Game of Thrones episode I've seen. It doesn't mean that the show itself is going to fall off, you know, its pedestal and turn into a crappy show. And it's still worth watching, but when you're holding it against the standard that Game of Thrones has made, it doesn't stand out as one of the best seasons, and it stands out to me as the worst season of the bunch, which still means it's probably going to get like a C-plus or a B-minus from me, which is very good for television standards.
And I think that's kind of where I'm a little weird about this, is because even this episode is better than about 90% of what's on TV. And it feels strange saying that, but really quick, I hate to focus on specific points, but in what way is Stannis' storyline ruined?
Okay, this is what you have. Okay, you spend season 2, and a lot of this is
No. I get that. We've been with the character a lot.
That, right?
But why
is it? Yeah, we build a character.
Why
so
is
pretty much
closure ruined? I don't understand, because I thought it was.
You are focusing on the event of, okay, Stannis, you know, does this bad thing, which, like, burns his daughter. So,
like, I mean, I understand
then,
it happens quick, but to say that it's ruined, I mean...
Yeah, it is pretty ruined. Why build up Stannis for all this time to, in 2 episodes, be like, okay, well, he knows, Melisandre says we should do
why
this,
build
you know,
him,
the shit's King's blood.
Are you saying, like narratively it doesn't
Stannis
make sense?
Yeah. You don't think Stannis was an important character this whole time? Why spend this much time with Stannis, right? All this time with Stannis... Then it's like, okay, well, we need, you know, her blood.
Why spend all this time building up Ned? I mean, this is not new to the show.
That's not the same thing. Ned,
it's not the same thing.
Seth, it's not the same thing. Ned died from, like I said, it's one fantasy tropes, right? Him dying moved the story forward. This is, let's spend all this time with a character who really's only real aim is a character could possibly win the throne. And then, like I said, in the course of really no time at all, he went from he wouldn't give up his daughter to, oh, Ramsay and 20 men sent a lot of people on fire. Okay, I should burn my daughter alive now. Oh, I did that. Oh, then men left. okay, now we're going to battle, and it's over. And I mean, somehow Brienne, who's done nothing all season, is going to kill me.
There's probably
what?
Some connective tissue missing, but I mean, I'm just
You're looking at it as point A, fact A happened, and fact B happened. In that regard, it's not as bad, but when you look at what happened in the fact that it's like, why spend as much time with this character to have that storyline?
And I don't know why we care about that.
Oh, so you don't like? Why do we spend this much time with characters of the storyline?
Do you feel like your
point?
Time with Stannis is wasted? Then is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I kind of do. Like, why spend this much time to have that week of a resolution? You like I said, if you think it's a strong resolution, you're just looking at it as it's cool that Brienne gets to kill Stannis because of you know Renly.
To me, that's why I'm disappointed by it. It's not necessarily that he died this episode, because if he died this episode, it would make sense with how the story had gone. But the fact that he dies due to an oath by Bryn, a character that I'm not personally that invested in, who is defending the oath of a character that's been dead and not brought up at all in terms of storytelling since season 2, it just does not have that much of an impact and feels insignificant. And maybe that was the point they were trying to do with him, like him dying with a whimper, and that being something that's interesting with that character, but it just did not work for me, and I was let down by it.
And I can buy that, but like when we start thinking of, you know, oh, all this time is wasted, we're kind of trudging some very dangerous territory. And this is something also
sure.
that I hate to throw this around, but I mean, it's damn hard to make television. It's damn hard to do what Benioff and Weiss are doing, taking, you know, this group of text and trying to, you know, translate it to screen. Not everything's going to work. You know, there's simply not time to go through Stannis's basically all the connective tissue, you know?
No, they could have.
I mean, if you're suggesting that they cut time off of Cersei's walk or cut a little here or just get rid of the whole Dorne storyline, I mean, I don't think that, you know, it's easy to say that we want that, but I don't think that it's that easy.
So here's the thing, you are defending, this is my opinion,
I'm not
right?
even defending,
Game of Thrones,
I'm defending its adequacy.
No, I think that being Game of Thrones, like I said, was a phenomenal show. My favorite season of last year, and I can't believe how good Game of Thrones season 4 was, right?
And
True Detective
and
got Hall of Fame.
In that,
yeah, whatever.
In that regard, then, I mean, we could, I don't want to get it simple, but can we, I mean, it's just spoiled us a little bit. I mean, I hate to say that, you know, because season 5 wasn't as good as season 4, season 4 is all of a sudden bad. Because the minute we start comparing and contrasting stuff, we can't. Well, I mean, we should, but we can't hold everything to the same standard because everyone's circumstances are different.
But your reasoning are, okay, well, it's hard to make this, so it's still, you know, good or above average. That's fine. No, that's not fine for what the show's given us. You know, why? We shouldn't be happy with something
regressing into
mediocrity.
And I'm not even going to
say
happy. I'm saying it's adequate, and you know,
it's not,
and it's still accomplished a lot. We should
I can't say that these guys, they're the ones in charge of the show, right? They are the ones in charge of what storylines they do, how they're going to pace things, right? So saying that it's hard and they could have done better, they could have done much better. In fact, this only showed me that these guys are great at adapting the source material from George R. R. Martin, and they're great at adding, you know, little dialogue in between that we wouldn't have gotten in the books. But they are not good with original content, and they did not do a very faithful job
and,
to what you know, the core storyline
and
is.
And that's very fair, and that's not what you said. And I can agree that, you know, what...
Oh, that's entirely what I said. That's, I think it's, I'm, you wanted
not
to think
say,
that
you
I
didn't
hated this
say,
episode.
You didn't say that, you know, Benioff and Weiss did a bad job. I mean, you're just saying that, you know, I don't know.
The episode was not as good. The thing is, this whole episode, this whole season was not as good, but this episode kind of represents everything that was wrong with this season in one super rush fell through the skip. We didn't even talk about...
And it was
the...
in a critical moment for this show in terms of its
I don't buy it.
It's not
that.
Like the show's going to fall downhill, but in terms of like the moments that they were trying to deliver for this season, it happened at a bad time because it happened at the moment these storyline payoffs were being delivered. And we're not going to really know exactly how this show is going to – how the series is – how these events are going to really impact the series as a whole until we get that sixth season and we see how these huge cliffhangers pay off. But I feel like in this moment, in this season, in a vacuum, this was kind of a letdown in my opinion.
Yeah, that's fine.
Even then,
that's all it has to be. I'd say
you wanted you're defending it as the it's not that bad. You know, and I don't like. I don't want things to be not that bad. I want them to be great.
And
you know?
I,
like, I don't
I understand
watch Walking
that,
Dead anymore.
And that's fair. And Walking Dead's a weird monster. And you know, I'm just sitting here thinking from the frame of, you know, not everything's a dud, but everything's not a gem either. I mean, and stuff can live in between the margins and live in transience. But you know, that's
time,
this is a
you,
big
you'd
picture philosophical argument.
You'd be upset if, you know, like I said, you weren't happy with Friday Night Season 2, I imagine. You'd be upset if Parks and Rec just dramatically jumped up in quality, and we'd be upset if Breaking Bad's, you know, Season 5A was really bad. Like, these are things that matter to us, you know?
Well,
we don't watch the show for above average. If I want to watch above average television, I'll watch, I don't know, like some random Fox show or FX show that has gotten middling reviews. Like, I can see above average television. We don't watch Game of Thrones and think, well, it was better than average. This is a show that had so many great elements. We'd even talk about the fact that Jon Snow, the best character of the season with the most interesting storyline, gets killed really quickly.
Yeah. Is he dead, though?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Now, Melisandre will bring him back, probably, I imagine.
It's set up for that, for sure.
I don't think
but...
he's actually dead. I think it was a body double.
just like Cersei,
like Sherlock
we
Holmes.
Didn't see her boobs.
It's like Sherlock Holmes. He's not really dead.
Yeah, I don't... And it's just kind of funny that, you know, they Judas is, you know, they did the whole, what is it? Brutus
for the
with,
watch for the watch
for Julius Caesar, like, you know, it's kind of funny that like Jon Snow is branded the traitor, but who's actually, you know, betraying who, and I don't know, it's just kind of, and then Etu Ollie or whatever you want to call it,
but it's, I don't know, it's kind of like they forecast that kind of was going to happen. It's
well,
obvious
book
that
readers
no
book readers knew it was going to happen, I mean, you know,
yeah,
for a long time.
Well, it was ambiguous years. Like it was ambiguous. It was like, you know, we didn't know that. Now, like I said, I'm pretty sure Melisandre's going to revive
just
him.
Just so we know, Kit Harington has a 6-year contract with an option for a 7th year, so he's gonna be back, guys. Don't worry.
He's going to be back as the ghost of Christmas past.
I want to say it's one good thing before I get to another thing I'm disappointed about for Season 6. I am happy as hell to have Varys and Tyrion together with Tyrion in some form of power. This is going to be fun. And it's probably the only thing I'm particularly looking forward to next season, because the rest of stuff, I mean, Arya, yeah, I'm looking forward to that for sure. But, like, Dario and Jara are going to go search for Daenerys, who's surrounded by Dothraki. Why? Why are we doing
who's
this?
Who's stuck in the
filler?
Middle of a filler arc.
And they're both going to become stone men. I mean, I don't know. It'll be interesting. I'll still watch the show, obviously, but, like,
I mean, I'm not quitting on the show. It's just, this is my favorite TV show on television. With the beloved book series, I'm disappointed. I was so happy, too, because Fallout 4 made me forget about everything, because that happened right after the episode. I was so happy with Fallout 4, I forgot about how unhappy I was with this episode, and now it's all back, and I'm just...
what else?
Well, we got True Detective. We got True Detective Season 2 this week.
Yeah, we could talk about the Silicon Valley finale that no one watched.
Yeah, go ahead.
Look, it's kind of funny. I'm pretty sure that episode... I've heard so many good things about Season 2. I'll burn through it at some point. I just remember that this is my defense for you know, your argument here, Seth. I remember I wanted all of us to watch Silicon Valley for one of our episodes, and I watched the episode. You only watched it kind of within the background, and David didn't even watch it. So,
sorry.
You know, I gave up on trying to talk about Silicon Valley frequently or even watching it once that happened. So that's my defense there.
No, I understand. I mean, it's the kind of thing that as soon as I actually devoted some time to watch it, I'm reminded about, oh, this is so much better than what I remember in season one. I mean, it's a good show, and it's only half hour. It's only a half hour, guys. It's so easily digestible.
It'd be fun to do a season spoiler cast for Silicon Valley once we all see it.
I can burn through it. When I get back, I can just burn through it.
Like
3.5 hours.
Yeah, like I said, it's a half hour each episode, and it's, you know, it's funny. I don't remember a show that I've laughed out loud as much as at that show. So.
Well, as you mentioned, David, a show I'm sure we'll talk about this on a decently frequent basis. True Detective Season 2 is here. We put True Detective in the Hall of Fame for 2014. For the first season. David, this is your love child, your baby.
I love the whole existentialist philosophy that they have going off that show. It's not going to have as many of the Lovecraftian elements this season. It's not going to have kind of the cult aspect. But the ambiance, the atmosphere... The acting is all going to still be there, and that kind of brooding tone that, you know, Nicholas Pizzolatto brings to the storytelling. I'm excited. There's no show really like this on TV. It's going to be interesting to see. This is a season that's completely unrelated to the first season from what we've heard in terms of building up, and we're going to see, at this point, what kind of crime we're going to get. I mean, I really have gone into this pretty much blind, with the exception of knowing who the actors were. And I'm excited to see how this plays out. I mean, I know that Billy, you're a huge fan of Vince Vaughn and Colin Farrell.
Everyone's a fan of Vince
and
Vaughn.
Seth's looking forward to Taylor Kish.
I'm just looking forward to the product too, because they got probably the best actress they could have possibly gotten for that budget.
Yeah,
like I'm trying to think of who's better than Rachel McAdams in terms of what they're going after.
And that's who I'm. Like, we're all, it's something funny. We're all watching. In terms of the actors they have on the show, we're all kind of interested in separate actors. I mean, we're all interested in the entire product and all the actors involved. But in terms of the, you know, the people we're interested in watching, each of us kind of has like the one that we're looking at. I'm looking at Rachel McAdams. You're looking at Taylor Kitsch. Billy's looking at Colin Farrell and Vince Vaughn and seeing how they're going to perform these roles. Because, I mean, the casting in this show is really interesting. I mean, Colin Farrell's probably the only one in this show that really kind of fits the archetype of the character that's, that he's playing in the show.
He's also the only one that needs it, but that's a different argument altogether.
Yeah,
well,
that's true.
Well, it's interesting because Vince Vaughn is pretty much the, I guess you could say he's the bad guy from what I've heard, you know, and I'm really excited to see that side of him, you know. And Colin Farrell's the more interesting detective role, which
he's the Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, he's the Matthew McConaughey this season. Rachel McAdams, in a lot of ways, is going to be the straight man of the show, from what it seems, like the leading character, the one that's one the most grounded one that we're probably going to see the world through. And I'm not entirely sure what Taylor Kitsch is, except I know he's a highway patrol officer.
He's
and,
playing
and
apparently a retired, like an ex-military veteran. He's playing a military veteran from my Iraq war that's coming back.
Yeah, he'll be
he?
The badass.
I don't want to turn this into some kind of feminist thing, too, but I'm just really glad that if Rachel McAdams is a co-lead. I thought that one of the best things and worst things about the first season of True Detective was Michelle Monaghan's character, and it'll be interesting to see what... I don't want to say someone with better acting chops does with it, but I thought that Nick Pizzolatto did a good job of writing for female roles, and if Rachel McAdams kind of delivers, then it'll be really interesting to see, because there's not that many strong female characters in TV, even still.
No, I mean, movies have turned around, definitely, and video games have kind of also sort of turned around.
Yeah,
but television in the Golden Age is still kind of behind, which is a little strange.
I think Golden Age is over, personally, but that I digest.
Actually, essentially, Horizon's the game you talked about, David, your favorite. Another female lead, you know, which is actually interesting. That's a
Syndicate female lead.
Well, they have twins. They have British
My character
twins.
In Destiny, the female lead.
Dishonored 4. I mean, Dishonored 2, not Dishonored 4. Dishonored 2. So it's definitely an evolving trend. I'm just excited because it's a different kind of... Like, we're not getting the same thing, which is exciting because I don't really want the same thing. True Detective Season 1 was kind of a unique element, and trying to copy or imitate that wasn't really going to work.
And frankly, they're not working with all the same pieces, because I'm not sure if Fukunawa is going to be around for as much in Season 2. I haven't read
that's
that
That's another thing
before.
That's interesting. They're going from that singular director that like directed all the episodes in Season 1 to doing more of a typical television scenario where they're going to have separate directors, which I think is kind of an overblown issue when you're looking at the show. But, I mean, if you look at Season 1, one of the things that was great about it was that consistent tone.
I don't think to say it will be, a detriment is kind of underrating just how good Fukunawa was.
He was excellent. And it's sad to see him disappear from the It movie.
Well, we get Justin Lin, though, for the opening episode. He made the good Fast and Furious movies, Fast 5 and Fast Furious 6, so that's before the crappy Furious 7, so that'll be interesting to see what he does directing the first two episodes.
Crappy or guilty pleasure?
Well, no, I love Tokyo Drift. That's a guilty pleasure. Furious 7.
Tokyo Drift
terrible.
Is, like, the only Fast and Furious, outside of Fast 7, that I've seen. And
Fast 5 is the best one!
I actually really like Tokyo Drift.
It's, like, the best guilty pleasure movie. It's so much fun while immediately being really stupid. And I don't know. The thing I'm actually kind of looking forward to see with Season 2 is I know you love every aspect of it, David. To me, half of Season 1 was phenomenal to a certain degree, you know, and the other half was not as good. You know, I think it took a little bit for me to really get into it, and the sixth episode was a letdown. I want to see, you know, Season 2 really start off strong and keep my, like, really into interest. So this is something I'd want to talk about every week on the show.
No, I mean, we'll
I'll go ahead and openly admit I didn't see True Detective. You know, I saw it in maybe two sittings. I didn't see it week after week after week. So it'll be interesting to see if I can digest it in the same way.
No, it's definitely a slower paced show, which kind of somewhat benefits from the Netflix standpoint, because then you're able to, like, since there isn't as much going on, you're able to kind of digest more of it at the same time, like Breaking Bad, and kind of get a more holistic picture of the show. You can consume more of it than is given to you in a single week's time. Game of Thrones, you can kind of enjoy and get your kicks out of the single episode.
I was about to compare the two. Would this season have been better if we saw it all in one set?
Maybe.
I don't think it would have, because I think, like, you still have the... Maybe it'd been even more annoying to be watching the... I think if they knew that people would binge watch it, it could have been done a little differently compared to, like, the week. You know, you wouldn't have the finale is jam packed, but I don't know.
The orange is the new black type of things.
I mean, I will say though, with Game of Thrones, with True Detective season one element of the show, which I really did enjoy in terms of it being a once a week deal, was all the aftermath that happened online. I mean, I went to, right after I watched the episode, I'd be a total nerd and go to the Reddit page and look at the Reddit True Detective page and see what everyone's crazy furious for what would happen next week, and you know, everybody obsessing over the Lovecraftian elements of it and like all the hidden conspiracies that everyone have of it. That it really became kind of a phenomenon. And that was really an enjoyable thing to be a part of. And so I'm interested to see what happens with this show, with this season. Is it going to have the same sort of element of people following it, you know, weekly and going on to the Reddit page and really kind of becoming part of a True Detective community? That's going to be a really interesting thing for me to follow personally.
Well, I think a fun thing for us to do before the first episode on Sunday, I want you to predict who dies of the main four cast we know of and who gets nominated for Emmys.
Great.
Yeah, so David, you go first. No pressure or anything.
All right, well, I'm going to say that Rachel McAdams gets nominated, and I'm going to say that I think three of the four will get nominated. I know that sounds crazy. I think that it's going to be interesting to see how they do the leading role and the supporting role, but I think that, you know, Rachel McAdams gets leading actress. I think that Vince Vaughn gets the supporting actor, and Colin Farrell gets the leading actor. And I think in terms of the people that die, I'm going to say that Taylor Kitsch's character dies, and I'm going to say Colin Farrell's character dies.
Oh, he goes Vince to jail Vaughn's for goes his jail. Brother's murder is what's going to happen.
That'll be interesting.
Taylor
Kitsch. I think Vince Vaughn ends up going to jail.
What about you, Seth?
I'll keep it short and sweet. McAdams dies, McAdams wins the Emmy.
Okay. I think that I'm with you, David. I actually think both Farrell gets, you know, Farrell gets lead, McAdams gets lead, and Vaughn gets supporting. And I think that – I think it's – Taylor Kitsch seems like he's going to be the, like, montage at the end, you know, talking about what happened or something, you know? I wouldn't be surprised if Colin Farrell died, and I wouldn't be surprised if McAdams died. So I'm kind of – I think I'm with you on the same page there, David.
We know nothing about this show, man.
I think
– We're totally – I just want you to know that, like, we're totally blowing smoke out our
you know, in episode 4, when Vince Vaughn looked at his wife and had that phenomenal monologue, I it was really heartbreaking to listen to.
We've seen so much of his show already that we definitely know who's going to die. I mean, we're looking at our crystal ball here, our crystal ball of bullshit.
That's
we had to drop our. I used our one cuss word here.
I can't believe.
And then Owen Wilson pops up, and it actually is just a stealth pilot for Wedding Crashers, the TV series.
I just can't wait till Sean Bean dies in episode 4. I mean, when they brought him in, I knew he would die, but still, wow. All right, well, this has been a very jam-packed episode. Me and Seth got in there a little bit with Game of Thrones. Don't worry, we don't have to talk about it anymore. It'll be gone for a while, so that'll
be good.
I mean,
whatever.
Hey, we're free to talk
about debate.
I'm not that bugged by it, I guess. That's all.
The conflict will carry over to the next episode. We got a storyline going on here.
Whatever your opinion of True Detective Season 2 is, I'm going to disagree with you completely, Seth, just for fun. And David,
that's
I just want
to
remind everyone.
I agree that you're going to disagree with me.
Oh, no.
David will come up with conspiracies of what's going to happen next in that storyline. I also want to point out that David has still not seen all of Daredevil.
But y'all haven't seen Jurassic World.
Okay,
that's
fair.
That's acceptable. I didn't have to pay $10 to go see Daredevil.
Well, you do pay whatever subscription is a weekly for those, so technically...
If you give me $10, I'll finish Daredevil. Not really. I mean, I'll watch it. I'll watch it. I'm going to watch it before True Detective.
That's what you said. That's what you said 5 weeks ago. Next thing you know, you're going to look at the watch so excited for some True Detective, and then, you know, oh, crap, I didn't
watch it. Like the guy from, I'm going to be like the guy from Twilight Zone. There's time now. There's time.
Time is a flat circle, guys.
And then it'll be off the Netflix series.
Or you're going to be like Benedict Cumberbatch, you know, I just need more time.
Hey, anything's possible.
All right, well, anyways, I'm Billy White.
I'm David Hunter.
I'm Seth Junior.
Oh, I was hoping you guys would say it at the same
Shut
time.
Up, Billy.
Anyways, all right, we're getting out of here. Thanks for listening, everyone. See you next week.